What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Most people think that getting stronger means pushing harder in the gym. But what if the real key to performance is learning how to train without breaking the body? Today, we're talking with Dr. John Roosen about his system that he uses to train athletes and everyday lifters to build strength, fix pain, and stay in the game for the long haul. Dude, you've been doing this a long time. I mean, I listened to you on Dave Tate's podcast, and I mean, obviously, I've seen your name pop up a bunch. So, I mean, it's great. I mean, the book was extremely thorough, thick. I'm glad they gave me enough time to go through it because I always feel like it's disingenuous. I'm sure you've gone on podcasts where you send the people the book and you're like, this fucking guy had no idea. He didn't read the single thing. And you're like, God damn
it. It's a hard one though. You know, like when you deliver somebody a 600 page textbook, you're like, read every word. Like that's a hard ask for people. I get that. But that has been the situation a couple times.
Yeah. I didn't read all 600. I just went to all the stuff that I was kind of looking for, like floating through. So I shot you over questions, which I think will be pretty good. So we'll get rolling.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Let's do it.
All right, cool. Hey, today's guest is Dr. John Roosen. Russin?
It's Russin.
All right, well, let's start again then. All right. Hey, today's guest is Dr. John Roosen, a physical therapist, strength coach, and creator of the Pain-Free Performance System. So over the past decades, he's worked with everyone from professional athletes to everyday people who just want to train hard with consistency and without getting injured, which feels to be a major issue that we run into with most people that when they start getting into training, there's always this fear of injury. And as a former professional athlete, injury was never on my mind. Safety is the last thing in my mind, but I've come to the realization that most people aren't wired up like that. And the fear of getting hurt and the fear of being injured is a major block to overcome. And, you know, so you put together an education platform that's certified tens of thousands of coaches around the world. And the approach blends rehab, performance training, and longevity into a system helped to get people to move better, be stronger, and live a healthier, happier life. So we're having you on. We're going to discuss a little bit of the new book, Pain-Free Performance, where it pulls together all these years and all these different methods into one framework. And so kind of wanted to dive right in.
Let's do it.
All right, cool. So as I was going through the book, you make a point that people focus too much on movement and not enough of the setup. Like what are the biggest setup mistakes that you kind of get into and kind of like give us a high level on like how you get people into that first experience of like moving well and understanding that just moving from point A to point B isn't the goal. It's to move well through that range of motion.
Well, when the body is in movement, it's dynamic. It's the equivalent of the shiny object syndrome. So as coaches or even as athletes, we always want to fix everything as it's in motion. And many times that's not the actual fix that helps us stand up against time, load more, or even move with higher quality biomechanics or efficiency. We really put a lot of emphasis in on pre-training preparation, pre-movement preparation. And what that really breaks down to is a breathing and a bracing protocol that can be strategic, especially when you're in the gym. So essentially, we're just trying to link up maximal breath intake, and then we want to be able to brace around something we refer to as the pillar, the shoulders, the hips, and the core together, not just the core, not just the abs, and be able to link these two fundamentals together so we're actually setting up for success and being able to have more success when somebody actually does get into that dynamic form of the movement.
So how do you like emphasize that to an individual when you bring them in? Like imagine I've never lifted weights, I've never trained. You get a person first day and I don't know what movement you necessarily start with, but I'm sure you have like a series of diagnostics that you put people through to kind of teach them how to use their trunk and how to brace before you actually put them under, you know, 500 pounds instead of just loading a fucking 500 pound bar on their back and being like, all right, hold this thing up and fight it to the bottom and then somehow stand back up.
Yeah, usually the 500-pound squat doesn't happen on day one in our pain-free performance program.
But I mean, it could. It would just be more pain.
It would just be, yeah, a little bit more random in terms of what would actually happen after. But we essentially want to be able to make people able to take in a breath and be able to feel what a reactive brace might feel like. And many people think that they're bracing. I know that I thought I was teaching and coaching and doing the brace at a 10 out of 10 level. And then you get around people that really know how to brace, how to breathe, you know, referring to like the best bracers in the world, the power lifters. And all of a sudden you're like, yeah, I don't know shit. And that was my experience over a decade ago, is that we need to be able to take a 360 degree breath in. We need to be able to put tension into the hips, into the shoulders, and be able to have a brace protocol that actually feels strong and stable and powerful and loading of the canister. But essentially what we do is none of those sexy things. We lay them down on their back, we bend at the knees, we have the feet flat on the ground, and we have them stick their fingers right into the sides of their abdominal cavity. And we ask them to cough. Hard cough, none of these, one of those.
Yeah, like when you used to get the old sports check in basically. Like I was going to say, like the old sports check when we were playing sports. Remember you had to go for the deal? And the
hernia check, yeah, that's the type of cough. I personally did a very low hernia cough when I was a youth athlete. But today, you know,
I used to give him the, like, and that was our hilarious thing is because, you know, we'd all wait in line and then the kid that could get the funniest cough. So sorry, that was a little sidebar, but.
No, it's very relevant. And that's kind of how we explain it to people that don't quite get it. But we want them to cough loud, like a big excursion. And all of a sudden they feel all of those four layers of abdominal tissue turn on all at once. A rapid turning on of the entire pillar. And all of a sudden you're like, that is the glass ceiling. That is a spinal reflex. So that's kind of what we're going towards. But we don't want you to be coughing under the bar. We don't want you to be coughing during your sprints. So we actually just go through a more premeditated bracing process where we start putting tension through the shoulders, tension through the glutes and the adductors to control the hips. And then we breathe through the nose. We brace through the core. One last sip of air through the mouth, and then we are stacked and ready to move. And I think that that is one of the things that's been most protective for my athletes and my clients, but it's also skyrocketed their strength output as well, because the more stable you are, especially when we're looking at the more of the traditional strength lifts, the stronger you're going to be because the less force leak you have.
One of the things that was interesting for me, it was, I always looked at like the belt as more just something to like a cue for me to be able to like kind of like brace my trunk. But when I went out to go, you know, train out at Westside with Louis Simmons, they were putting their belts a little bit loose and then were pushing their bellies out as hard as they could into the belt. And Louis had me do it one time. And I felt like, honestly, I was going to give myself a hemorrhoid. Like that was the only thing I felt. And I was like, man, I do not. And I said to Louis, I'm like, I feel like I'm like going to blow an O-ring and get like a hemorrhoid. And he's like, you don't have those? I'm like, no, I've never had that. Cause I constantly think about drawing everything in, like, especially like, you know, big toe on the ground, squeeze the glutes and like, think about like pulling everything inside of me. Whereas this position where you're pushing me out, I'm almost like pushing everything out. And like, it just was a very weird sensation for me. And Louis's like, oh yeah, no, that's very common. You would get hemorrhoids. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not doing that. I'm not like that was, I was like, no, I've seen too many guys mess with that. I've avoided that. But he was surprised. He's like, man, most guys that have lifted weights and trained heavy have some form of issue with that. And I always thought it was felt from that like idea of pushing the belly out as hard as they could. Just always felt like a potential for, you know, hemorrhoids or abdominal tears. So like, how do you kind of like, I mean, it's not pushing your belly out as hard as you can. It's kind of this in between of like filling your trunk full of air and actually creating tension. This episode of Power Athlete Radio is brought to you by the Business of Strength. Trainer School 2026 is upon us. It's a one-day elite coaching workshop built to accelerate your career, increase your income, and make you a highly sought-after coach. On January 23rd, join top coaches like Mike Addison, Scott Leach, and the Business of Strength team for a full day of hands-on systems, business strategy, and real-world coaching tools. No fluff, just results. So if you're ready to level up your skills and stand out in the fitness industry, register now at businessofstrength.com/attend. Build your career, build your strongest year. Are you a field or court sport athlete looking to dominate the leaderboard? let me introduce you to Field Strong. Take your inner athlete to the next level by exposing yourself to the advanced training techniques that contributed to my 10 years in the NFL. Unlock pinnacle performance and level up your athletic potential today. Head to powerathletehq.com/FieldStrong and claim your 7-day free trial. Now back to the show.
It's the age-old debate, right? It's like, do you draw in or do you push out? I don't think it's a debate. I do not think it's a debate because we look at trying to draw air in, you will have expansion happen. If you're drawing air in, especially if you're getting to that tidal volume up to maximal capacity, as close as you can to getting as much air in as possible, you are going to have expansion that comes anteriorly on your belly. It's going to come to the sides. If you're really good, like the guys at Westside, you can get expansion into your lower back. And all of a sudden you have this canister filled up. But what you do from there, I think, is more of a coaching cue, or it's more of a visualization of what you want to happen, bracing around the air. The air is good, but being able to draw in around the air is what you're talking about. Yeah. And that is going to be the most protective. And that's where we see that our clients can keep the best spinal alignment as well. So I do expand, but it can't stay expanded. Then we need to contract around it. And that happens by controlling the shoulders and the hips. A lot of people go wrong because they forget about the ball and socket based joints above and below the spinal complex. I think that we need to control these things because they're the most mobile joints in the body. Otherwise, we're going to have to pick up tension somewhere. Usually picking up tension at Westside or anyone who trains in that style means that you're going to be overstressing the pelvic floor. Overstressing the pelvic floor leads to exactly what you're saying. It's going to be more strain on your asshole, and it's going to be more just injury to your butt, which is no fun for anyone who's dealt with that.
The feeling, and like I remember exactly, it's like, I'm going to blow an O-ring. Like that was like the feeling like there's like a pressure ring in there. It's going to pop out. And that's like a very weird, and I'm sure you've dealt with women, especially through pregnancy, that have had weakened pelvic floor. So that idea of like teaching them to draw in and actually strengthen that pelvic floor is a major component.
Men and women, the women are going to be like, yeah, more the textbook. Hey, you just had a baby. Hey, you're 3 to 6 months out from that trauma. But men today are dealing with exactly the same issues. And a big thing that we've done to mitigate these issues is to be able to just reteach from the ground up. Everyone thinks that they know how to get their core tight. Everyone thinks that they have strong abs. And it's a totally different thing being able to maintain your movement integrity while you're under near maximal loading.
Sure.
And I think that is what we need to be focus on. But to the point of the belt, at Pain Free Performance, we don't even teach the belt. We don't recommend the belt. And we go beltless for 99.9% of the things that we're doing. Even with the power lifters that I am managing, I will have them go beltless in their 6 to 8 month off seasons.
Nice. No, I mean, I'm a huge proponent of squatting without a belt. I always look at a belt as like, maybe the last set, like you throw it on, above 85-90%. Like once you're kind of getting up in those upper registers, you should be able to squat 80-85% pretty comfortably without a belt. If all of a sudden, I remember back in the day when we first started training, it was like belt and wraps at 135. I remember I look back and I'm like, God, we were so fucking lost. But like, I mean, literally we were like wrapping our knees in warm-up sets, and the idea of like learning, which I can't even fathom why we did. But then I remember coming in and realizing like, this is stupid. Like this is taking me, 90 minutes to get through the squat workout because I'm putting all this shit on. Like, let me just ditch it and see if I can get through this thing faster.
More than that, I think that people that are gravitating towards overusing equipment are the ones that are trying to use it as a crutch and not as a performance enhancement tool.
That's what we were
doing. If you are an advanced lifter, if you are looking to break, 100%+ of RMs, a belt's going to be a huge performance tool. But if you are strapping the belt on while you're taking a piss in the bathroom before you're getting into your warm-up, then that is going to be a crutch that's going to hold you back ultimately for the rest of your training career. Anything should never be used as a crutch. We should be able to have independence of our own body as naturally as possible. And then if we can sprinkle in some of these tools, then they become a method to enhance performance, not pull back from your core requisites of just fundamental movement.
So one of the major issues I'm sure you run into is people with back pain. And, this idea of like teaching people how to brace under load is an incredible way of fixing it because it's teaching the mechanics. How does that go down the chain? When you start thinking about like into the hips and the knees, where now all of a sudden they're bracing the trunk, does it create a more advantageous position? Because I feel like, the amount of people that I'm encountering now that have fucked up hips, you know, like worn out hip sockets, I feel like more and more people, like I didn't notice this 10 years ago, and maybe it's the age, maybe it's the demographic, but like I keep running into people that are, you know, in their 40s and in their 50s that are now having double hip replacements. And like, I'm like, where did all of a sudden this come from? Was it a change in mechanics? Is it just, you know, poor posture? Is it bad movement? Is it bad, you know, locomotion? I mean, you know, you think about, you know, why do these injuries end up coming up? Are they overuse? And so just wondering how that kind of fits into those below the joint, below the back.
You know, specific to a barbell sport athlete, I think that we are stuck in the dogma. Specific to the hips, let's tackle that one first. We are stuck into deadlifting out of inauthentic stances. You know, we're going too wide so we can host more weight, and we are taking it through less of a range of motion. And when it comes to the squat, you know, you only squat to parallel because why the hell would you ever go under that?
Sure.
And I think that this is essentially partial range of motion training. Partial range of motion is going to be associated with higher load capacities. Higher load capacities over time through a partial incomplete range is going to have chronic wear and tear mechanically into the joints. But I think neurologically as well, it just kind of tightens down the entire chain, and we deal with mobility, stability, and functional issues that then go more and more and more into the chronic stress of the joints. And it's not only the chronic stress of the joints from, again, a mechanical perspective, just from a neurological perspective, we are essentially detraining a fundamental movement pattern with the squat and the hinge. And many of these same people, it's like against their religion to split their stance and go out in to do some single leg training. Yeah. And I think the combination of three of those things lead to, you know, 40s and 50s, your hips are beat to shit and you're looking for a surgical route as opposed to kind of like building back the links that you were missing previously through learned dysfunction.
Yeah. You know, years ago we had Stu McGill on the podcast, and I one of the interesting things I remember from that podcast, and it was many years ago, was the outcomes for back injuries associated with surgery are really terrible. Like if you, you know, if like given the option from a back injury, it's better to rehab just because the outcomes are so bad. Whereas I feel like once the hips are kind of shot and, you know, that ball and socket is kind of laced in there and really wearing the joint down, there's really nothing you can do to fix it. And at that point you're looking at, you know, hip replacements, but then, you know, like what is the longevity of a hip replacement? 20 years. So you get one when you're 40 and, you know, 15 years maybe. I mean, so unless they kind of change up the materials or find a better way to kind of progress it. I mean, you know, I think all you end up getting is about two shots of that. So being able to get people to train and be healthier for a longer period of time to be able to push that stuff off.
That's the key. But people are stubborn. People want to do what they want to do, and they want to do it that way only. And to be able to break them down just a little bit, to be able to basically have them save themselves, that's the business that I'm in. Every single day I'm dealing with high-end athletes and clients that are super into training that have fallen into more of like a one-size-fits-all dogmatic approach. And it's what they love to do. And I'm not in the business of taking it away from them. I'm making sure that they can do it for the next 10, 20, 30 years. And there has to be some concessions being made. And many times that's with the amount of volume and intensity that we start moving, the movement patterns, trying to optimize them for their bodies and not the cookie cutter that they thought they needed to do for the last 20 or 30 years, because the NSCA textbook says this is how we squat.
Sure.
And we break them down little by little in order to help hopefully restore some of their function, get them feeling better. And then that is the way that they buy in and they actually have longevity with a new style or some changes in the training approach that they ultimately know that they need to make. But I think that people are just scared of losing their strength. They're scared of losing their muscle mass. They're scared of losing their identity, which is being a lifter. And once we get past that and show that there are many roads that lead to Rome, then people tend to buy into feeling good, because there aren't a whole lot of people out there that just take pride in fucking themselves up. Like, I want to go to the gym 7 days a week and be in catastrophic pain to the point where I can't walk out, and this is how I live. Those people are a rarity. The people even like that, that can see that, hey, I don't have to feel this way in order to get the results that I'm after. That's the epiphany that, you know, we're always after with pain-free performance. Mm.
So you talk about scale of tension, and, you know, instead of just telling people to like brace as hard as you can you kind of get into a little bit of like under bracing, over bracing, and what that scale of tension is?
Well, scaling to tension is extraordinarily important, but the first thing that we need to do in actually scaling it and getting a qualified scale is looking at what maximal capacity actually is. You know, just using myself as an example, before I started training in Columbus, Ohio, I thought I was maxing at 10 out of 10 brace capacity. I was at like a 6. So I didn't even know what 10 was. So then when I go to scale back my tension, I was at like a 2 or a 3. I'm like, man, why, 8 reps into a 10 rep set, am I breaking down? It's because I just didn't have a qualified top level of what my glass ceiling was. So we want to teach 100% max capacity brace first as a skill. And then based on the activity at hand, we need to match the brace and match the tension or the intensity of the brace with the activity. You know, the way that you squat a 1RM is at 100% max brace. That means that we have no breath going in or out. It means that we're holding our breath and we have no exchange. So as brace goes up, breath needs to go down. And it goes little by little based on the activities at hand. So say you're taking a breathing set of 10 reps with the barbell on the back squat. Of course, you're not going to be able to brace at 100%. You're probably going to have to bring that down to 70%. Say you're doing a goblet squat challenge, 50% of your body weight in a dumbbell, in the goblet position, trying to break a record of 25 plus reps to pure failure, you're going to probably have to bring that brace down to 50 or 40% in order to actually get some breathing in, but also to be able to withstand the stress of maybe muscular endurance. So I think that based on the activity at hand, that premeditated brace needs to go up or needs to go down. A whole nother conversation needs to be had with a premeditated brace, which is like something that you would do in the gym in a traditional lift versus a reactionary brace, something that you do on the football field naturally. These two things need to be trained differently, but I think that the more that we can control the premeditated brace and being able to have a process with that, the more potential that we have to be able to fine tune that reactionary brace or that functional brace, as it's called, when we actually need it.
So, I've for years called this task specific tension, like the amount of tension you need to execute your given task, right? So it's like the word fits with the definition. But where I saw this a lot of times was playing pro football. A lot of the skills that I developed boxing, because I boxed from the time I was probably about 10 years old. Like when you go in there, you have to keep this task specific tension, like you're pretty loose. And then obviously as you're punching out, like being able to snap, or if somebody hits you, being able to absorb that. But like if you're too hard and you watch guys, you know, bite down too hard in a mouthpiece, they get hit and then they end up like, you know, out like a light. But even that like task specific tension of being able to move, because if you're constantly bracing and pulling as hard as you can, it's next to impossible to be able to move fast. So that like, you know, and trying to explain to people that like the tension has to match the movement and, you know, what you're necessarily trying to accomplish. So I do appreciate that piece, but how do you teach people that? Because one of the things I've run into for years with like a rate of perceived effort, you know, RP, you know, great system, but for an advanced lifter that actually understands what a 10 is. So what I've come to the conclusion is that most people have never pushed to the upper register. So they have no concept. So whenever they start talking about, you know, rate of perceived effort, I'm like, if you don't know what a 10 is, then how do you know what a 2 or what a 6 or what a 7 is? And I feel that the only way you know is if you've trained at a certain high level. So how do you kind of combat that?
I agree. That's a big reason that I won't use an RPE scale, is because the vast majority of people will never get to what a 10 out of 10 actually feels like, nor should they. You know, even for some of my really intuit lifters that are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, it's like, do we really need to get there? No, not necessarily. But in terms of being able to train the brace from a premeditated state versus reactionary state, I think these are two totally different things. You know, the way that you could potentially train them in the gym for a reactionary brace is having some sort of perturbation, some sort of randomization in terms of you being able to control load moving through space. A good example of that would be sled work, kettlebells, anything that has a perturbation, even like a hanging band technique, because you have to continuously pick up a brace when there is that change in direction or that change of lack of stability. And that is great. But one of the best things that I think that helps on your reactionary specific task-based bracing is actually doing the task. Like, we're not trying to be everything to everybody in the weight room. We know where our opportunity points are. And sometimes, you know, when you're looking at bracing through sprinting, let's work with your sprint coach on that, because they're going to be the experts into how to bring that brace down to next to zero so we can actually force transduce. I think that many times in sports performance, we try to almost emulate the thing or the task or the sport or the skill that they're trying to get on the field or court. Yeah. And it's just not that. No. We're trying to build physical capacities that stand up against time. And then when they're bigger, when they're stronger, when they're faster, when they're more explosive or more mobile or more conditioned, then they're going to have more opportunity point when they actually go in and start fine tuning those skills when it is their sport specific endeavor on the field.
Amen, man. God, I couldn't have said it better myself. Something I've railed against for years, that like everything we do in the weight room is essentially sharpening the blade, so that you can hand the blade over and then the individual can use it in a meaningful way. And that, like, you know, sport specific training does not happen within the confines of a gym. It happens within on the field or the pitch or the ice or whatever. So, with the athletes that you work with, I mean, you work with powerlifters, with pro athletes, you know, high school athletes, is everybody that comes through. Is there like a higher degree of coachability dependent upon, you know, certain sports or what? Like, do certain people catch things faster? And I think like that's like a great indicator. I'm sure you've seen this too. When you can work with high level people, they pick things up extremely quickly. Is there, you know, different methods for teaching this? Or, you know, I'm sure some people, you're like, hey, brace your core, they understand it. And then other people 6 months in, you're like, dude, we're still talking about this. So like, how do you kind of like scale this for each individual? Or how do you continue to kind of hit that whack-a-mole so that you can kind of get everybody moving in the right direction?
The people that pick this stuff up the quickest are usually the ones that are in pain or dealing with some serious plateaus where they're about to quit whatever they're doing. Those are the people that are going to be most responsive to being able to focus in on a new process and being able to actually dig deep on those layers to be able to rebuild themselves, because they're at risk of losing what they need to do, whether it be an athlete or whether it be somebody that just loves to lift. As counterintuitive as it thinks, I don't know what you think about this because you've worked with this population as well. Sometimes your best athletes, the highest performers, are the ones that are the hardest to coach in the fundamentals or the foundations of movement skill, because they've gotten away with so much almost their entire lives. And they have always been the God-given athlete that could do almost anything. You could pick up a skill very quickly that could translate into performance or into winning a game, but not necessarily staying healthy for the next 5, 7, 10 years playing that game. And that is a tough athlete to work with, because there's ones that, hey, why would I ever change anything that I've ever done? I'm 23. I'm making $20-30 million on the field on Sundays. What the hell do you know? Those are very hard athletes to deal with. The ones that are the easiest are the ones that probably have had to grind a little bit in the youth model. Most likely were slow, or they were small, or they were not the best when they were 14 or 16 or 18 or even 20. And they were always having that chip on their back. They were looking for the edge. And the edge for us in the weight room is having a movement mastery. Having a movement mastery and being able to engage mentally and emotionally, not only physically, in the process. The athletes that I love to coach that can actually peel back that onion the fastest are the ones that have always been the grinders, that didn't have the God-given talent early on. And now clearly they're here, they're doing great things, but they have a mentality that they want to be a master at what they do with their body. And I think that if I were to say that there is one particular athlete or sport that I work with that really translate well into movement, it's going to be like the skill athletes, whether that be like point guard, shooting guard, and basketball, used to putting in the reps of 1,000 shots per day, fine tuning a motor skill, or whether it be a baseball player, probably the baseball players, that's my background, is being able to not only have to be mechanically sound on their swing, but also on their base running, and of course on their throwing. So it's like all that stuff really translates well into movement mastery when it comes to the gym itself. The ones that are the hardest are probably football or rugby or some of the Olympic sports that are strength-based, because it's like, no, I just got to be strong. I've always been strong. This is what I do. I'm already the fastest. What the hell are you going to teach me? But everyone's going to be an individual. As generalized as that sounds, it really is individual by individual.
Cool. Use the term centration. And can you, for somebody that's never heard that, like, what does that actually mean? And like, how does that like change when a joint is properly centered?
Yeah, centration is neutrality of joints. So we think about just stacking the skeleton in biomechanically advantageous positions, and that allows us to do some really awesome things. You know, you think about two bones having maximal surface area contact. At the deepest of levels, that's great stability. You go one layer out from that, you have those tiny little intrinsic muscles that are actually at proper length tension relationships to be able to do their thing in terms of more dynamic stability in joint spaces. And then you look at even like the secondary or tertiary stabilizers, which are mostly the prime movers, like those big thick muscles that everyone focuses on in bodybuilding. Those are actually put into positions where we can actually go through ranges of motion. We can gain mobility. We can dynamically stabilize that mobility, and good things happen. Now, I think that centration is a very important topic that doesn't get talked about a whole lot, because at the deepest of levels, if we have biomechanically sound positions, we are able to translate that up chain into all the things that I just mentioned. At the deepest of levels, if we are simply not in neutral and we are not in centration, then it's very hard to be able to pick up tension, pick up stability, express full and complete ranges of motion, because we're always having to essentially compensate somewhere. You know, force leak is a big thing.
So how do you get somebody in to teach them that? Like, I mean, we talk about it like a neutral hip. You know, one of the things that drives me crazy is when I watch people go to squat and the first thing they do is they flick their hips back and then all of a sudden create this, you know, overemphasis in their lymphatic curve. And next thing you know, they're like, oh, my back hurts so terribly. So like little tricks like, I like loading people up on the belt squat and putting the belt squat on the hips and like forcing into that neutral and then forcing them to kind of, you know, spread the ground, sit back, you know, squeeze their glutes and try to keep that neutral hip as they're going through, opposed from just like flicking back. And, is it movement selection? Like, that's the way I teach it. I just look for movements that I can force them to do what I want. Because a lot of times, as you talk about these things, people just kind of go to their reptilian brain and shut down and just want to move from point A to point B and like not understand that like how you move from point A to point B is really a deciding factor for not only athletic performance, for health, and all these other factors. Like, can you move well? And I've found that just a lot of people don't understand what good movement is. And so...
The way that we start people out is not what I learned in the 2000s in physical therapy school. Hey, you know, there's perfect posture. Perfect posture, shoulders back, spine neutral. The hips can't be into a posterior pelvic tilt or an anterior pelvic tilt. That's going to kill it. And then they try to like position you. They position you and they say, just stay there. Just stay there and then move. It's like, nah, that doesn't work. That's the equivalent of me telling my 10-year-old son at the dinner table not to slouch over as he's eating his chicken.
Well, like, is that because people don't lift weights? Like, that's one of my gripes with most of the PTs. Like, they don't look like they lift weights, and a lot of them don't have any understanding of how to move it under load.
I would agree. And I would also agree that that's not actually their right to win in the industry. When you look at, you know, what is your X factor to helping people? Physical therapists are awesome at helping people get through pain. That's what they're great at. But when it comes to being able to then optimize performance, you know, that's a different profession. We're talking about strength and conditioning. We're talking about personal training. We're talking about performance lens of the spectrum that aren't dealing with a clinical level pain source. But back to like the posture thing, it's like positioning people and just like having them sit there, that never worked once. Thousands of years, it's never worked. So what we do is actually very similar to what you were mentioning. We just do it in a different way. So we want people to naturally find their centration areas. We want them to find their own neutrality, because where you are the most neutral, you have the biggest potential to be the strongest. And where you are the most neutral and you're the strongest, you have the biggest potential to be the safest. But we can't just like do this biomechanical model where we're just looking at everyone from a joint by joint approach. We need to have the brain and the body and that connection lead to where we are strong and safe. And that's by putting pretension through some of these big secondary stabilizers. When we're talking about trying to find a centrated shoulder position, I'm not going to place the shoulder into that position. I'm going to have somebody contract their pecs, contract their lats, have maximal capacity, then draw it back. And you will find very quickly that everyone will have the shoulders depress, slightly internally rotate, and then the shoulder blade will stick on the backside of the thoracic cage with all those 16 intrinsic muscles really having a stability factor on them. Think about trying to coach that on somebody. Okay, slightly internally rotate 7 degrees, depress 20 degrees. oh, one muscle of the 16 on the shoulder blade is out. Like, it's ridiculous, but that's what people are trying to do with some of these corrective exercises. So we let tension build. And as that tension builds, it feeds in quality patterns. But what we try to do is have on one side of the joint versus the other side of a joint, a co-contraction happening. As that co-contraction happens, it actually modulates compensation. So taking it down at the hips, we're not talking about, okay, just keep the hips in neutral. We're talking about bringing in the big abductor group, that complex, bringing in the big gluteal complex, having those things co-contract because they're happening in oblique slings and having them control that hip position. And then we start talking about the properties of tension and then torque and then overall centration that actually translates into them being in a position where they can move safely from.
Mm-hmm. How much of this movement do you equate to, like, I mean, so let's give you an example. Like one of the things that we were running into a lot is the only time we really see hip extension is when people sprint with the knees behind the glute. Finding ways to replicate that in the weight room is next to impossible, other than like maybe a Bulgarian split squat with the when the knees behind the glute the whole time. So like looking at like these fundamental patterns and like, you know, I do love the knees over toes guy, the fact that he's had that branding, but the fact that he's like, nobody squats knees over your toes. And I'm like, if you ever sprint, your knee is over your toe the entire time. And if you ever get to a point where it's not, you're going to reach and you're going to run into some of these problems. So you can kind of see the mechanics of like sprinting and movement and what we know in terms from sport and being able to take those pieces and say, all right, you know what? People do need to squat with their knees over their toes. They do need to do something where the knee is behind the glute and kind of finding these different positions and then finding ways. And you were talking about unilateral training, which like was a massive thing for me. You know, I came from an Olympic lifting background. And then the first time we started kind of doing lunging and some of these Bulgarians, I was like, oh, now I get it. Like that was like a light bulb moment, but playing football, we were always on one leg. You know, I mean, think about putting your foot in the ground. Like, you know, you might start in a staggered stance, but you're always in a position where one foot's kind of hanging in the air. And so the fact that we teach so much bilateral, how do you like teach that to your athletes? For me, it was very simple looking at sport and looking at the demands and realizing like, all right, I'm not trying to mimic this, but if these are the demands of sport, these are some of the movements that I need to start focusing on. Like, how do you take that conversation with your athletes? How do you teach them that? Or how do you hammer that home?
With athletes, it's pretty simple because anytime you split your stance and you're doing single leg training or asymmetrical lower body training, that's our lunge pattern and pain-free performance. It is going to be extraordinarily challenging. It's going to be challenging on the muscular system. It's going to be challenging on the metabolic system. It's going to be challenging on neurological systems all at once. And we call it the oh shit moment. You know, you've ever had an athlete that was like bilateral dominant their entire career. You get them out into something like a reverse lunge, a Bulgarian split squat, and they're getting absolutely crushed with next to no load. And they go, oh, I think there's something more to this.
This was me. I squatted 600 pounds. And the first time I had to do a walking lunge, I almost thought I was going to collapse. Like I couldn't stabilize. I couldn't step through. I couldn't get my knee over my toe. And I remember thinking like, this is a massive problem. I play a sport where I'm on one leg and I can't lunge. Like that was like that oh shit moment for me.
Well, 85% of our movement lives happen in asymmetrical lower body stances or single leg stances. And we just don't replicate that in the weight room. And I think that maybe we shouldn't be doing 85% single leg work, but it should be closer to probably 40 or 50% of your overall volume that you're placing through a program. I had this anecdote that I told in the book in one of the chapters. It was actually the lunge chapter. And I find myself coaching on the Chinese Olympic Committee over in Beijing. This is about 12 years ago at this point in time. And I was working with the best athletes in the world, you know, even some of the Chinese Olympic weightlifters, legends. And they're doing things that you watch them on their platforms in practice. And you're like, holy fuck. Like that was one of the most amazing things that I've ever seen. And then he's just continuously doing that, repeating for the next 5 or 6 hours. And then all of a sudden, like they hire guys like me to come in and they're like, okay, John, you know, now you do functional training with them. You know, they realize like their sport specific training wasn't functional, you know, the semantics of the word, but we used to do functional training with them. And one of the first training blocks, we got these guys in and we started having them do Bulgarian split squats. It was like 8 or 10 reps per side, no big deal. Because it's group training, you know, you set it up, everyone's going to do the same loads. We're just going to work them through little by little. And we had something like 35 pound dumbbell sitting there. We had the benches up and just a traditional setup. And all of a sudden, these guys that are squatting ungodly amounts of weight, throwing weight over their head that I couldn't even pick up off the ground, they're getting crushed by 35-pound dumbbells. And I couldn't believe it because I was sitting there and I was like, Jesus, like this is not what I expected. This is not what I expected whatsoever. And the fact that they struggled that much wasn't because they weren't strong, wasn't because they weren't muscular. Their legs looked like my torso. It was because they never split their pelvis opposite directions. Yeah. And just as you alluded to, what can we do in the confines of the weight room that allows us to go into pure hip extension through a complete range of motion and also allows us to go pelvis one way anterior tilt, pelvis the opposite way posterior tilt, because that's kind of the way the pelvis works, especially with some of the supporting musculature.
Sure.
In my mind, one of the best ways and one of the only ways you can do that is by doing single leg training. And this is what allows this to be so functionally transferable to any sport or any endeavor that you are standing on 2 feet. I'd even argue that it would be transferable into things that you don't stand on 2 feet, because that's what the locomotive system requires in order to put output. So that is one of the misses that I see a lot of programs really struggling with, is that we start struggling with lower back pain, with knee pain. And then you look at auditing programs like that, even in the professional sectors, and you see that they're not only neglecting single leg work, sometimes it doesn't find its way into the programs whatsoever. And this is just one of those gaping weak links that you can correct right away. You know, in the story of the Olympic weightlifters in China, they were able to, over a 4 to 6 week period, start, you know, going 100 pounds, 120 pounds in a hand for eight, like not even sweating. But it was that neurological skill that they were looking for. But were we trying to make them stronger in their sport? No. Were we trying to make them bigger in their quads? No. What we were trying to do was making sure that we could put training volume in a different way that wouldn't stress their back and would strategically stress their knee in different positions and bring in all the stabilization that they naturally didn't get in their sport. And that could be said for any sport. Training the rule of opposites in the weight room, as opposed to the demands on the court or on the field or in their platform, that is really another principle that is highly missed. If you want to have a complete movement system, if you want to have a complete physical characteristic system, we need to give them what they're not getting. Of course, we can give them what they can get better at, what they naturally have, but we have the biggest opportunity to go through and give them the rule of opposites so we can just be as well-rounded as possible. That's how health is facilitated.
Yeah, and those guys squat jerk. So it's not like they're split jerking. So, I mean, they're really never in a position where they're not in some form of like bilateral squatting, hip hinging position. So being able to get them through. And then the other thing, which is interesting, if you ever look at those guys, I'm sure being up close, extremely shallow hip sockets, you know, they can, which is a, you know, characteristic of the Asians, just shallow hip sockets opposed from like a very deep hip socket. So they can sit real well. And then they're all slightly bow-legged. So like they don't have to like externally rotate their knees already in that position to create that internal hip torque. So like whenever I watch those guys, I'm like, man, those guys are built to squat. You know, like slightly bow-legged, shallow hip sockets, like, you know, big quads. I mean, those guys, and they move extremely well underweight. I mean.
As stereotypical as that sounds, it holds up against the research as well. 2017, I wrote the first study about how people need to squat differently based on hip anthropometry that was published in the NSCA journal. Yeah. And people argued me even 10 years later. They're like, no, everyone should squat the same because everyone's the same. We're all humans. You haven't taken enough data points to look at this, because we know as coaches, people need to set up differently on their squats.
Sure.
They need to be set up differently on their single leg work. Our tibia versus femur ratios, our TF ratios are going to be different. Our hip anthropometry in terms of the angulation, the size, the depth, the shape, it's all different. And then you take those two variables, add it to your torso versus your lower lengths. You're dealing with people that couldn't be any more different. So why would we all move the same? But going back on what you said about some of the highest performers in Olympic lifting, it's not that it's like, hey, everyone was like this and they all came through and they're all awesome. They were most likely the ones that were just weeded through hundreds, if not thousands of people in the youth development model that made it to that point, were healthy enough to compete at that point. It's going to be just the survivorship bias when they get to that level. But you will see commonalities. What allowed them to survive when the other 950 did not survive over the last 7 or 8 years? Many times it's the ability to naturally get more centrated, naturally to control force leak, naturally to be able to transfer force, and to be able to be healthy enough to just continue on. I think a lot of people don't think about, hey, you just need to remain healthy if you want to actually chase down any athletic endeavor. There's a reason why in the NFL, people are only lasting 3.3 years on average. And it's not because, man, these guys really suck after 3 years.
No, they're cowards.
You would think that you would get better.
No,
you
know, they're
you
cowards.
Get smarter. It's no, injuries. Cowards. It's pain.
No, they're just fear. It's cowards. That's why they only last 3 years. No, it's when I playing 10 years was like incredible. Now it's like, you know, like looking at the present NFL, I'm surprised that guys can't play 20 years. I mean, it's just not nearly as physical as what it once was. The one thing that I did take away from the Chinese weightlifters, it's almost, and dude, you can speak to this. It's almost as if they developed a system and then they looked for lifters that fit into their system, just because if you look at their body types, they're all very, very close. So I think, like, you know, whereas if you look at like the Russians or even look at the Bulgarians, the body types were different. Whereas I felt like the Chinese like figured out, like, if these guys can do it, we just need to find more of these. And the other thing too is their approach of bodybuilding, like looking at all their accessory work and what they hit. I mean, those guys are, I mean, you know, those guys are jacked. I mean, they look like pro bodybuilders. And move extremely well. But then when you see all the accessory work they do and like the dumbbell rows and the, you know, bench, I mean, which is not typical for the most part, because I felt like Olympic lifters always thought like, oh, if you're too muscle bound, you're not going to have the flexibility. But the Chinese proved obviously very different.
Yeah. It's, you know, stack the favor in the numbers and somebody's going to come out of there. That was one of my biggest takeaways is, we'd be training some of the youth athletic development models, the teams, just as teams, you know, 30, 40 people at once, multiple of those, development teams. And then week to week, month to month, people would move in and out very, very quickly to the point where you had trouble even understanding who you were training. Mm-hmm. And it's just because, hey, if you can perform at 10 years old, you're not going to get to 11 years old. If you couldn't perform at 14, you're probably not going to make it to 15. And there's just so much optionality. And even between some of the youth teams, you know, they'll be taken from sport and put it into this sport and that sport. And it was wild. It was like musical chairs working over there, just trying to do as well as you possibly can. But yeah, you know, if you have a bigger pool of people, if you are training super hard, more people and harder training will lead to success.
Do you think
for a couple of them?
Do you think success early on hinders? Because some of the best athletes and some of the best, not going to say athletes, but some of the best people that I've ever encountered in sport tended to be late bloomers. That they weren't necessarily great when they were young, so they had to develop a great work ethic. I mean, I was one. Like, until I started lifting weights, I was 6 foot, 165 pounds, and then, you know, I had to put on weight. And I was, I took my daughter to a basketball camp this weekend, and she's like 14 years old in eighth grade, and like seeing like some of these girls are really good. And like, you know, like listening to this, like this coach and this guy talk about recruiting, which I think is hysterical that we're talking to eighth graders about getting recruited for college. But like, that was, you know, one of these things where, you know, he said, he's like, you know, if your daughter's not performing at this level, you have to decide whether or not this is the road that she wants to go to. And it was kind of an interesting piece, because if somebody had told me when I was in eighth grade or a freshman in high school, you know, you probably shouldn't do this because you're not very good at it. I don't know if I would have continued to train, or, you know, at that point I was like, well, shit, I'm just going to do the best. And, you know, next thing, a couple of years later, I ended up with a bunch of scholarships and get a chance to play college football and go on and play in the NFL for a decade. I just think it's pretty interesting that we're kind of segmenting these kids and kind of giving them these, this dose of realism at like such a young age. Whereas, you know, I mean, whatever happened to, you know, the Michael Jordans getting cut off of his high school team, I mean, the ability to build work ethic and be able to mold yourself into an athlete through training and through progression and through opportunity is such a massive piece.
I'll preface this statement in saying that you can't control when your child hits puberty. You know, that's not within your control for the most part. But exactly what you're saying, there are highly, highly advantageous positions that you can get yourself into as being the quote unquote late bloomer.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Early bloomers are tough to maintain. Being the best at 10 means that you're on the peak of the pyramid, and you have to maintain that to 12, to 14, to 16, maybe to 18. And then all of a sudden, you're still a couple years away. And when we do become the best, I think more than just a physical mentality, it's a mental and emotional thing, because if you are the best, if you are the biggest, if you are the strongest, if you're ahead above everybody else when you're 13 years old, it doesn't guarantee you that it's that way when you get to 19 or 20. And we're starting to see this even in some of the American youth development models, where they are picking all-American teams, they are picking Team USAs, and they're starting to take into account, where are you on your puberty scale? Mm-hmm. Like, are you going to have the skills that when you do indeed hit puberty, which everyone will they transfer up? Because if you're picking a Team USA 12U for baseball as an example, you're going to pick the 6 foot kids that weigh 185 pounds that are hitting 400 foot bombs out of a 200 foot field. And that's how you're going to go and win. But we're realizing that, like, who gives a shit? Who gives a shit if you're winning at 10U or 12U or 14U? Nothing matters up until the point where you can sign an NIL deal for a Division I scholarship, or in some sports, you can go pro at that time. So 18 is really where we start to see the entry point. I will argue until the day that I die that we should be playing multiple sports up until the age of 15 or 16. And when you're 16, it doesn't mean that you only play one sport all year round. It means that the weight room and speed training becomes your second sport. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you have 2 years of concentration to get you to the next 6 or 7 years to hit your peak to exactly where you need to be. But there's a huge advantage to having a chip on your fucking shoulder, having to figure things out. And I'll say, I'm the father of the smallest kid on the basketball court, but he's also the best and most skilled kid in the state of Wisconsin on the basketball court. And he is a foot shorter than everybody else. This is on the top of my mind because I coach a team and we just played for the state championship last Sunday. Nice. We ended up losing the state championship, but out of 176 teams, we made it to the last game and we almost pulled it off. We had 3 kids sick, and that's not an excuse, but that's the reality. But when you see what you have, 176 teams in the state of Wisconsin at 10U fourth grade basketball, what are the things that stand out? The things that stand out are pure athletic abilities. They are nothing to do with shape or size or even skill at that level. It's how good can somebody move? And it doesn't matter where you are on the puberty scale at that point in time. A quality mover can always scale up into sports specifications of skill. And I think that we need to put more of an emphasis on building a better, more robust movement profile. And the only way to do that is by getting diversity in the activities that you do. So if you're the best 14-year-old, awesome. I'd rather be the 50th best 14-year-old and be the best scholarship winner when it came to 18, because I was playing baseball, basketball, and football all along.
Yeah, no. One of the guys I know shot me this, like a clip of this kid. I think it was something on Instagram, who was like, I think he, 17 or 18 years old, going and just got a college scholarship and signed to some big, NIL deal. And, he's like, man, this kid's like 6'7", 300 pounds. And like, he sent me this picture. The kid had like a full mustache and like a beard. And I was like, dude, when I texted him back, when I went to college at 18, I didn't own a razor. I didn't start shaving until I was 21. I was 6'4 and I grew to 6'6 in college. So I grew 2 inches in college. And I was like, man, like this dude looked like me at 26 when he's 17. And we're seeing this more and more. These kids are so much more physically developed. I'm like, I don't know what's happening in the world that all of a sudden these like 17 and 18 year old kids are looking like 26 year old men. But like, I just didn't see that. Like when we went to college, everybody was kind of baby faced. And like, I remember I showed up and my roommate's like, do you have a razor? And I'm like, no, I've never shaved. And I didn't shave until I was 21. So I think, I don't know if something in the water, something in the environment or whatever it is, but like the physical development of these kids is so much more dramatic. Could it just be the fact that maybe they have more access to information? Maybe they're training at a earlier age. It could be food. I mean, I don't necessarily know what it is, but I feel like, with the access to information we have today, like nobody's hiding.
I agree. Yeah. I think it's multifactorial. It's absolutely environmental. We can't discount that. But in terms of kids training earlier and earlier, they are developing and getting stronger and getting bigger. And by the time they are a junior or senior in high school, they are probably 4, 5, 6 years ahead of what people were 2 decades ago. But I don't necessarily think that lines up to long-term success. It doesn't mean that you're going to be a pro. And there are more challenges that you'll face by being an early bloomer or an early developer or the best at an early age than it is having to grindstone and figure things out because you were good enough to make the teams. I think that needs to be said. You need to be good enough to participate, but you also want to always be like in a position where you're like better than half the kids and you're definitely worse than half the kids. Mm. And you know that you can have shining star success, but you also need to make sure that you're doing what other kids aren't doing in order to get development in. I think it always comes down to development. But, you know, we know that on the developmental model, you know, when you start seriously training, you have 7, maybe up to 10 years, depending on the sport, to be able to peak. And if we're peaking too early, that means that nobody is going to get where they need to be ultimately.
How do you avoid that, getting people to peak too early? The only thing when you said it, I kind of laugh. Like my mom used to make this joke where she's like, you know, a lot of guys peak in high school. And she's like, what you want to do is peak later in life. And I'm like, yeah, I was hoping once I got to the NFL, I would peak. But that's something that people run into. Like people have their greatest moment. They're at their greatest, you know, level of physical capacity at 18 years old. Like, how do you like, I guess it's just the luck of the draw. Certain people, I mean, like late bloomers. I mean, to me, I feel like it's a lot better. And I always tell my kids, I'm like, God, I hope you're a late bloomer. You know, if the best year ever is at 17 or 18, I want to be my best in my 20s. Like I hit my best strength numbers when I was in 26, 27, 28 years old. If the strongest I ever was when it is 18 or 19, I would have never made it as long as I did.
I'm in the business, but you know, as you know very well, you know, your business becomes what you do with your family as well, because sure. You know better. Hopefully you know better than everyone else out there.
Yeah, and but then they don't believe you. That's the other thing I run.
Potentially, you know, depending on your kids, but I'll use an example of what I facilitated for my son. He loves basketball. He loves baseball. He doesn't love judo. He's tri-state champion in judo. And he's won Minnesota State Championships, Wisconsin, nice. And Illinois. Oh, wow. And it's not something that's God-given for him. But the only reason that he does judo is because he gets his ass beat 3 days a week. And sometimes it's by girls. Sometimes it's by boys that are bigger or smaller than him. But it is a humbling experience. Oh, yeah. And it's mental fortitude because there's no easy days when it comes to martial arts. I never grew up in martial arts. My dad was an athletic director. I was baseball, basketball, football the entire way. But I knew that I had a weak link when I came up, and that was what I wasn't going to have happen with my son. So judo is that for him. He needs to be mentally tough, and he needs to learn how to compete when he knows he's going to lose. Yeah. So basketball is a different skill set. Basketball is a pure movement skill set. It has metabolic capacity to it. You are running. It's a running and agility and change of direction. And you have so much variability on what's happening. We talk about reactive bracing protocols. We talk about being able to be an athlete. Basketball is great for that. And then the exposure to being able to be a power athlete, to be able to express power in a very concentrated way with baseball, whether it be pitching, whether it be hitting, whether it be sprinting down a ball and catching it in the outfield, that is a very skill demanding sport. So he has to really lock in on very specific mechanisms of how your swing mechanics are, how your pitch selection is. And it's 3 very different things when it comes to his 4 months of a sport focus. But many times with sport specificity, we'll go all in on one sport, or we'll pick 3 sports that look exactly the same. You know, we'll go from soccer to basketball to lacrosse and be like, hey, we're playing 3 sports. It's essentially all the same movement profile.
Sure.
So if someone were to be able to like stave off the early sports specialization, it would by playing multiple sports. I think like as many sports as possible between the age of, you know, 8 all the way up to 11 or 12. But then when you get to 12, maintain 3. And if you were to try to have like a healthy movement profile, have 3 that have different requisites. And then at that point in time, you're going to be as well-rounded, I think, as we can possibly get somebody.
No, judo's a beast. I do jits, and one of the guys I train with, Arash, is a black belt in judo. And when we stand on our feet, like, I know that I'm going to get thrown and being able to land. So my son does jits, and like he plays baseball and basketball and plays a bunch of different sports. But jiu-jitsu is one of those that I keep telling him, like, it's the most humbling thing, because you're always going to encounter somebody who's more skilled, a little bit bigger, understands it a little bit more. And I was like, you go 2 days a week, there's somebody out there going 6 days a week. And every day we go in there, and I'm like, I had to go. He's like, I got choked. I'm like, don't worry. You're like, it's just part of the deal. But yeah. It's so good for, you know, the one thing I worry about baseball is it's so one directional. You know, they swing one way. And I always tell the coach, I'm like, can we get them to swing from a left-handed stance? What about learning to throw with the left hand? Just looking for some form of balance. And unfortunately, they're like, no, we don't have time for that. So what I like about jits and some of those other things is they have to be multi-directional. And then also you think about, you know, we're always in this kind of standing up kind of position. And now all of a sudden with judo and also jiu-jitsu, now all of a sudden you're on the ground and it's this kind of 360 gyroscope. So, you know, different planes of motion, you know, supine, prone, everything. So that's a good piece.
The power of training on the ground. Wow. It's so simple. It's so simple, but we can do this in the gym as well. It's like everyone really overemphasizes the standing position. Very rarely will we split our stance, but we can train from quadruped. We can train from tall kneeling and half kneeling. We can train from side planking positions. We do a lot of those developmental positions for that exact same reason. It's not going to be as advantageous as like having somebody on you trying to get out of these positions and spiral tension. But I think by just having more diversity in terms of your movement selection, there are many different ways to expose our body to gravity working on it in different directions and different requisite stability skills.
Yeah, no, I'm in agreement. I did martial arts from the time I was 6. So I got into, you know, my older brother, typical like 80s story. My brother got beat up by the local bully. My dad took him to some martial arts place. After about 3 weeks, my dad just took all 3 of us and dropped us off. So I was about 6. And then about 10 years old, I thought kicking was stupid. I think I saw, I think it was Marvis Marvin Hagler versus Tommy Hearns. I think they called it the war. I think I was about 10 years old when I saw that fight. And I remember thinking, like, kicking is stupid. Like, I only want to punch people. And that's when I got into boxing. And it just so happened that all the skills I developed in boxing translate incredible to playing offensive line. Like, first meaningful touch, how you cut a guy off in the ring, like being able to like play 2/3 inside out, like head position. I mean, all this stuff. I was like, when I went to go play football, and I didn't play football until I got to high school, I was like, oh shit, this is like boxing against people that don't know how to use their hands. I can do this. And so it's pretty interesting that, you know, there's certain skills and certain things that you can develop at a young age that you don't realize pay dividends till later, and you don't necessarily know what those will be. You know, like I've been fighting with my daughter. She plays basketball and she runs track. She does high jump and runs the 100 and can't figure out, or no, I'm sorry, the 110 hurdles, can't figure out how high jump and 110 hurdles translates to play basketball. So this is the conversation I'm having with a 14-year-old, and I'm like, wait a minute, you can't see how these sports translate into basketball? And she's like, no, not at all. How is this going to make me better at basketball? Won't more basketball make me better at basketball? And I'm like, no. There's a development of athleticism, and there's a model of GPP and physical preparedness that like all these sports with track just be able to put in. I'm like, if you're fast, coaches will find a way to play you. If you're slow, they're going to have to find a ways to hide you. And, you know, and then also, as I joke with her, I'm like, slow people don't play in the NFL. Slow people don't play professional sports unless it's curling. So, you know, you need to be fast and you need to foster and develop speed at all times. In the book, you talk about the perfect squat. So what is everyone getting wrong, and what do athletes need to do to attain their perfect squat?
I think they need to go back to looking at their unique individual bioanatomy. You know, as deep as the hips are, what are your TF ratios in terms of your shin versus your upper leg bone? Where can you specifically have success getting in an advantageous position to explore your unique full range of motion as you're training and being able to maintain that for a lifetime. Because if we can train more full range of motion, if we can withstand the stress of training a lot and heavy, we're going to get bigger, we're going to get stronger, we're going to potentiate power, we're going to have so many different things that happen, opposite of what we mentioned starting off the podcast of like square peg, round hole, only to parallel, feet shoulder width apart, only 15 degrees out at the toes because the textbook told you so. That is what people go wrong with the squat. You know, we've certified over 20,000 strength coaches, personal trainers, physical therapists, physicians over the last 9 years at Pain-Free Performance Specialist Certification. And we do all this in person. So we get these bodies in front of us and we're like, wow, we see a room of 70 to 80 people, and we have so much diversity when it comes to people's optimal squat setups that it's laughable that somebody could all squat the same based on their goal. That's where people go wrong. I have a hypertrophy goal. Well, I have a power goal. Well, I have a sports performance goal. Therefore, I need to squat this way.
Sure.
That's just not the way that it works. We need to be training uniquely for our body. The squat has the most movement variability when it comes into the hips going into full flexion, the knees going into full flexion, the ankles going into full flexion, us managing our pelvis, us managing our spinal position. There's a lot going on there, but as much as there is going on in a complex movement setting, that means that we have that much diversity. I think this like hit me right in the ass when I was in a surgical suite in my postdoctoral residency. And, you know, a physician was, surgery was going through total hip replacements, one after another, after another. And it was part of the postdoc residency to just sit in for 4 weeks. And I just watched the surgeon work in the corner of the room. And every single time he'd like carpenter him up, and then he'd leave the room for 15 or 20 minutes and he would be doing a consult with a medical device specialist. And he would sit there and spend 20 minutes looking at all these different components. A couple weeks in, I finally got the muster up to say like, hey, how many different options were there when you go to trying to match this type of hip structure when you're doing this replacement? And it was about 1,200 different unique options. To me, that's like, man, we have at least 1,200 different unique squat options.
Wait,
like,
so
why would we all squat the same?
So rewind. So he, when they do the hip replacement, he would go in, get them into surgery, see how their hip was moving, open them up, kind of look at it, and then go out and talk to the surgery rep to figure out which would be the right one for that individual.
Correct. You have two pieces of the components, so they have to match perfectly. So you have diversity on this one, diversity on the opposite, and then the shape, the size, the angulation, where they could actually find some optimization of what was would be new versus what was old. It was a biomechanical mastermind that was happening in a 15-minute period.
Wow.
And it just goes to show, it's like if it was easy as just putting in a quote-unquote hip, that wouldn't take that long, and you wouldn't have a specialist there in the hospital every single day to assist with it.
Wow.
You know, this is a physician we're talking about. This is an orthopedic surgeon.
Yeah.
And even he has to defer into somebody who truly specializes in this unique joint biomechanic.
Yeah. And I'm sure the most frightening thing is actually seeing them do the hip and realizing that these guys, like the violence at which they enact to be able to hammer this stuff out. I mean, it's like power tools and this and bone saws. I mean, like to the point where I'm like, God damn, like, thank God that they don't televise this because people wouldn't watch it. Where do you think, so this would have been in the 90s. I remember we always squatted below parallel, right? I mean, I trained with an old power lifter. We did Olympic lifting. I mean, there's no Olympic lifting where you don't squat below parallel. And then I remember when I went to college, the first time I squatted, they were like, whoa, 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 we don't squat below parallel. We squat to the top of the leg, you know, is more than deep enough. And I remember I continued to squat that deep. And then finally they had the orthopedic surgeon tell me, you can't squat that deep. The knee is at its most weakest point. You're going to tear your ACL. You're going to have injuries by squatting that deep. So I need you to, you know, stop at parallel. I felt like that was one, it was a terrible thing because for the most part, like, I mean, think about all the different positions that you're in. I'm like, don't you want to be stronger and all this range of motion? No, no, no. It's bad for your knees. The worst thing you could do is stop somebody at that position, right? Because it doesn't train the leg full range. And I felt like that died and people got into full range of motion training. But then recently, I've seen it kind of get a resurgence to the point where people start talking about limiting the range of motion, only squatting to 90. And I was like fascinated. I'm like, I thought we killed this 20 years ago. Where did this come from? This is like Ebola or herpes or something coming back around. I'm like, how do we dispel this? How do we beat this out of people? How do we go and throw a stake in the ground that's like, you should squat well? I mean, that's another issue we get into. If you can't squat well below parallel, then I need you to squat well to parallel until you develop the strength in the musculature and the ability to squat below parallel well. So like there's this kind of interesting balance. And I remember having taught a ton of people to squat. They're like, should we squat below parallel? I'm like, everybody should, but not everybody can. So then figuring out how you kind of progress people. But people that come out and like, oh, nobody should squat below parallel. I'm like, fuck, we killed this off long ago. Like, where did this come from? How did this resurge?
I think it resurged because people love loading at the quote unquote 90-90 because that is factually going to be your strongest position. You're going to move the most amount of load when you're at a 90 degree bend at the hip and you're at a 90 degree bend at the knee. And just to state this clearly, that doesn't mean that you're at parallel. You are far above parallel at the 90-90 squat. And the research will show
that. So what does 90-90 look like? Like a 45?
Yeah, basically.
Fuck. Yeah. Like quarter squats.
So that's become more popular and you'll see it in sports performance.
Yeah.
The reason that you'll see it in sports performance.
Dude, I see it on social media and I'm like, what the fuck is going on in this world?
Well, you'll see maximal load put on in this 90-90 or even above that to be able to load the system for different physical characteristics being trained. But what they don't show is that they're going full and complete knee flexion, full and complete hip flexion in unilateral exercises or in prehab-rehab drills. Sure. So it all equals out. Where we go wrong is that we only squat like this, and that is the only lower body exposure that we would get to a movement profile, and that is learned disuse. But we need to be able to understand that like not everyone's going to squat ass to grass either. We just need to be squatting as low as we possibly can based on our motor skill, our biomechanics, our unique body structure, and then being able to maintain that for a lifetime. I think that that is the key. We have this concept in pain-free performance called the motor control gap. The motor control gap is essentially the range of motion that you don't have active ability to get your own body into. But if you were to go passive, somebody else could get your body into that. You know, a good example would be like you do a body weight squat. Oh man, I can only get to parallel. And then you hang on to a squat rack and you go down. Man, I can get my butt only 3 or 4 inches above the ground. That doesn't mean that you can't do it. It means that you don't have the skills to go in and actually start to restabilize that bottom end range of motion. The only way to actually go and do that is to be able to pick movement variants to build the foundation back up of your squat pattern so we can restore that full and complete range of motion. It doesn't mean don't load. It doesn't mean don't do partial reps sometimes. It means that our central line of moving well needs to be being able to maintain that range of motion for life. And if we can simply just maintain that, then we can add specialty on top of it. But I'll use myself as an example. I can maybe get like 2 to 3 inches below parallel, and that's it. I have very square hips, so I'm very straightforward. Like my feet are basically forward. I'm about shoulder width apart, and I don't squat the same as everybody else. Somebody else can go down into our course and actually get their butt contacting the ground without posterior pelvic tilting or butt winking and a neutral spine. You know, somebody else might be just at parallel. It's very rare. It is very rare. Tens of thousands of people that we put through these different hip quadrant tests is what we call it in pain-free performance. It is extraordinarily rare that we can't get somebody to at least hit parallel. And the reason that people perceive that they can't is because they have a squat mismatch on their stance or their execution style.
Mm. My good friend, Dr. Craig Buehler, who's in Salt Lake City, he has a deal called AIMIT, Activated Muscle Integration Technique. I've had Craig on the podcast before, but he made an interesting observation to me once. He said, the body will not allow you to go into a range of motion and it cannot develop stability. So if you cannot, you know, maintain stability, the body just anatomically, like nervous system wise, won't put you into that range of motion. And if you've never gone into that range of motion and you've never developed strength and stability in this, like it's not all of a sudden magically just going to find itself. So you have to train yourself into it. That's why I tell people, like, I need you to squat well today. However deep that is, your body will tell us, but I need you to continue to fight for range of motion and as long as you're able to move well to effectively develop that stability.
For the squat though, you know, sometimes it's not just like, hey, this is just going to unlock over time. Everyone get a bar on their back. Let's fucking squat. And oh, we'll just hope and pray that your range of motion gets better. That's not what we do. We go in and we try to facilitate wins on a movement pattern pyramid. A movement pattern pyramid essentially says we're going to restore step-by-step up what we can facilitate in terms of gaining and maintaining a full range of motion as we go up chain. That turns into body weight squats, moving into goblet squats, moving into box squats, moving into front loaded anterior squats like front squats, and then ultimately getting into a back squat variation. And we move them up over time because this allows us to train full range of motion right away. It allows us to facilitate where the load is placed on the body or their unique setups to maintain that range of motion. And as we have proven that we are strong and stable, to your point, then we move up the next rung. And there's a million different squat variations that we can put into people. You know, we can change the stance, we can change the method, we can change the load placement, we can change the execution technique. We just need to find the one that allows them to squat naturally for them, load it, get strong, and then move up the stability and the load capacity. And that's how we chase up the movement pattern pyramids at pain-free performance. And this is liberating for people because most people don't give a shit if they do one squat variation versus another. Most people are just trying to train hard. They're trying to go heavy. They're trying to elicit a training effect and a stimulus, and they feel good that they're moving. And when they feel better, they're going to be even more likely to train harder and stay more consistent. But I think that that pyramid chasing has been extraordinarily advantageous for us because when we do change somebody's stance, or maybe they were like at West Side, they're super wide. No, your body dictates that you need to be narrow with a toe out. You can't just go, okay, squat like that the next day. We need to have some sort of rebuild capacity to allow the neurological systems to learn how to restabilize in a more controlled setting. Because we are most vulnerable to pain and injuries in ranges of motion that are novel that we don't have volitional access to stabilize.
A lot of people keep hammering through pain, and something that we keep coming back to on this podcast is training through pain, training through pain. Bad shoulders, bad backs, pissed off knees. Like there's always this kind of, I don't know if it's misguided, but like this goal that like the perfect program exists to fix me. And like, what are those I have this conversation all too often with people that there is no perfect program. And any program is going to need to be adjusted for you to continue to train. And like, you know, the idea of like, if a movement is causing pain, I need you to kind of pivot and find a movement that allows you to train pain-free. So like, how do you empower people to train pain-free and realize that if you're doing something that's extremely painful, you have to have more, arrows in the quiver. You have to have more available. If all you have is a barbell and the barbell hurts you, you're going to have to find something else other than a barbell to allow you to kind of continue to train pain-free. Like, how do you hammer that home? How do you accomplish that with individuals?
Pain is the ultimate limiter. Like, I don't care what your goal is, you are going to be less awesome because you're in pain. It is going to be the restrictor plate on your car every single time. But I do think that we need to meet people where they're at. I will have clients that like, they would rather fucking die than not put a bar into the bench press and be able to hit reps of 4 to 6 with it. Like, we just need to facilitate optionality in terms of, hey, what can we continue to give them these micro wins with emotionally? And be able to not have themselves just tearing away at their body. So something would look like just changing the bar, changing the range of motion, changing the angle of the bench, changing their hand placement, changing their setup, improving their brace, improving their ability to eccentrically lower. And then we start picking up the pieces everywhere else in the program. I think very rarely do people go in and go, hey, I'm going to put this prehab, rehab, preparatory sequence together with the same amount of mental focus in our warmups as we do with the actual training session itself. I think that 10 minutes of the warmup is our best opportunity to go at weak links directly, to be able to use some modalities that are self-help that make you feel good. And many times the people that are battling pain and injury issues, almost every single time they're not warming up at all.
Yeah.
So we put in a 10-minute phasic warm-up, and they start facilitating, oh, wow, I actually feel good before I go in and train. And then we can get them, meeting them where they're at with some of the movements that we can make slight variations to, keep their mental wins there, and be able to just take away the thing that is exacerbating. Our industry today, I shouldn't say our industry, social media's fitness industry today is all about the quick fixes. Somebody that wants to do what they want to do no matter what. I'm squat, bench, deadlifting, overhead pressing, no matter what, until the day I fucking die, fuck you. Those types of people, they're the ones that gravitate towards like, oh, my lower back hurts. What's the one exercise that will fix me in 2 minutes? And these are viral. These are the most viral things on the internet today. You have some of these high-end 8-9-figure marketers. They will tell you that the most viral thing on Instagram today is people in pain and having them be marketed at like victims and telling them that they can be fixed in 2 minutes with one exercise. Mm. There are entire marketing ploys on this bullshit. And it's just not true, because one exercise has never fixed anything. 10, 20, 30 years of moving like shit isn't going to be fixed by one corrective with a balloon in your fucking mouth with your feet up against the wall trying to breathe differently. That's just not the way that this works. I think that we do need to facilitate wins for the clients that are this like AAA personality. I'm going to do what I want to do no matter what. But we start building in different pieces that they've neglected. Warm-ups, cool-downs, prehab fillers. That's where we have a lot of advantages that we can place into people's programs without them feeling like you're personally offending them by putting them into a yoga class versus powerlifting.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the tissue has to be ready. The body has to be ready. I mean, like, that's where I look. I even took the word prep or warm up out, and I call it prep. That like, you know, we're going to get the body warm. We're going to pattern. We're going to move. Here's the movement patterns that we're going to be using within the training session. I need to pattern them in interesting, fun ways early on in the training so that you're preparing yourself to train. That one kind of blew my fucking mind, that most people just go in and start just cold. And I'm like, holy shit, dude, there's like a whole warm-up phase. I mean, at Jits, we do, shrimping and this, and like, you know, people are like, oh, fuck the warm-ups. I'm like, no, dude, like the warm-up is where you get to like actually get a little bit of sweat. You know, the old adage in boxing, if you go in the ring cold, you come out cold. Same thing in pro football. If like I wasn't walking off the field after pregame warm-up, like cramping to the point of like, I don't know how the fuck I'm going to do this, I ended up never having a good game. So like the body has to be warmed up. And I think one of the things, and I train a couple of the top Brazilian jiu-jitsu players in the world, is getting those guys in a position like where they are prepped and ready to train and understanding what warm-up looks like, and that they have to be, you know, somewhat sweaty and, you know, a little bit of rotation, a little transverse plane, a little bit of lunging, a little bit of this. I mean, some of these, you know, patterns we put in, I mean, this is what they're going to use. And I think we'd probably solve a lot of problems with pains if we could just get people to warm up a little bit and be prepared to handle a load.
Absolutely. It's common sense. It's common sense, but we tend to lack common sense in today's world. And we're not asking for a 45-minute corrective exercise session before you go in and bench press. We're really thinking about 8 up to 12 minutes at the top end. And it needs to be concentrated. Concentrated soft tissue, concentrated mobility, concentrated activation, concentrated movement pattern prep, so you can actually practice the movements that you're about to train heavy that day. And there's so much stigma when it comes to the warmups today. Like, just go into any of my posts on Instagram that are very educational. I'll be like, here's a 6-phase warmup. Here's how we would do it for somebody with shoulder pain if they had a bench press warmup. And they'd be like, no, fuck that. You know, just load up the bar and bench like a man, you pussy. And it's like, holy shit. And then that will have like 100 likes on it. And you're like, oh my God. Like, are these bots or are these people that are actually just personally offended that they need to actually prepare their body for performance? And I think that the simplistic model of training has become more popular today. But simple doesn't mean stupid. Simple doesn't mean that you just roll into the gym, throw 4 plates on and start squatting. Yeah. There has to be some sort of mechanism that allows you to address soft tissues,
sure,
gain full range of motion, be able to practice neurologically, dare I say, like prime the central nervous system with potentiation effects like PAP, skips, jumps, throws, jacks, things that allow us to heighten our state so we can perform the best when it actually matters, which is going to be our key performance indicators, the hard, heavy lifts of the day. You know, there's a process to this. And I think that if we can get people's mindsets like, hey, this will potentiate your performance and it will keep you healthier, you can't afford not to do it.
Amen. I listened to you on Dave Tate's podcast and I did Dave's table talk a couple months ago. Dave told me that he's the single most broken individual on the planet. And I was laughing seeing as that you've been on his podcast. Would you agree that Dave is probably the most single, most broken physical person you've ever met? I don't know, emotionally or mentally if he's broken, but just like as he was going through his laundry list of injuries and trying to find ways to continue to train, he's like, I'm the model for this. I'm the most broken person. And then he goes, ask John, if you ever talked to him on your podcast. And so I'm going to bring that one up to you.
I think Dave thinks he's the most physically broken person on earth.
I think he holds I think he wears it as a badge.
He does. He does. For anyone who doesn't know, I did a whole year of personal training, Dave. This is 8 years ago at this point in time, but they did a documentary series at Elite FTS on it. Yeah. It was called Fixing Dave Tate. And it was some of the funniest stuff ever. My wife, she'd never had seen it before. And we went out for the podcast in November and I brought my son and it was like our whole family was out there. So in preparation for the podcast, my wife watched like 20 hours of this documentary and she was just like, holy shit, was this entertaining? Because I would say, hey, Dave, we're going to foam roll this, you know, we're going to do this drill and then we're going to get you to do split squats and be like, oh, fuck that. And it was just like 20 hours of that. And it was extraordinarily tough, but like, the results spoke. Dave did exactly what he wanted to do. He regained his health. He regained his function. He was able to 5K walk with his son, who asked him to do it when he couldn't even walk to the mailbox a year prior. He was able to squat some crazy setup at Elite FTS with a spider bar and a box and reverse bands and chains and all this shit. And he was able to hit the number that he wanted to hit. That was his win. My win was like, hey, this guy's out of the fire in terms of his, he was at risk of losing his health, potentially losing his lifestyle. Yeah. So those are the types of people that I've come to work with. But I want to state, like, those aren't all the people that I work with. I am a big believer in the preventative model. More of my focus today is not picking up the shambles of somebody after they kill themselves for 45 years. Yeah. I'm in the business of like, hey, at 25, 30, 35, we're going to get out in front of this thing so we can extend your health and longevity today. You know, the earlier you start training smart, the earlier you start creating a more robust movement system and a well-rounded training protocol, then you are going to enjoy yourself for your 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. You know, it doesn't mean that we can't help people in their 50s and 60s that haven't done anything smart before, but I'm a big, big believer that the earlier you start to train smart, the bigger opportunity points that you have in terms of just living a better life.
Sure.
Like, yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, pain's an interesting thing. Like my relationship with pain is an interesting, tumultuous one for the fact that I knew if I was going to play in the NFL, you have to make friends with pain. And I kind of always viewed pain a lot like an old friend that comes in and sits down and stays for a while and then eventually leaves, opposed from running from pain. But I think pain is a great indicator. The problem is people's perception of pain is much different. I'll just give you an example. When I was probably 10 or 11 years old, I had a cavity. And my mom was pissed that I had a cavity. And I said to the doctor, I was like, hey, when he went to inject it, I'm like, can you try to drill this tooth without putting the Novocaine? I want to see what it feels like. And the doctor's like, no, we don't do that. I'm like, just try it. Just hit me. If I can't do it, shoot me the Novocaine. He drilled my tooth without any Novocaine and ended up doing the cavity without it. And I remember he came out and he told my mom, he's like, I haven't seen grown adults do that. And so I've always had a pretty good pain threshold. I mean, I've dislocated fingers and reset them in the middle of plays. I played 17 weeks with a broken leg. I mean, just the amount of injuries I've had that didn't really necessarily hurt me or they hurt, but it didn't limit performance. And I always kind of felt that like if something hurt enough or if it was fucked up enough, I wouldn't be able to perform at a high level. And that wasn't something that necessarily happened to me. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's pretty interesting when I talk to people about pain, I'm always fascinated to know like what's your perception of it? What's your relationship with it? Like, okay, you have a back injury. Is it limiting you? And then realizing like that people's perception, like we were talking about the RPE, their perception, is it a 10? Is it a 2? Because I mean, you go see the doctor, like I had knee surgery and you know, they asked me like, what kind of pain are you in? Is it a 10 or a 2? And I'm like, I have no fucking idea. I don't know what it is. 10 so unbearable that I'm throwing up that I can't sleep? Because if I can sleep and it hurts, but I can go to sleep, is that a 2? So like, I wonder as you get into this, when people say I'm in pain, like how do you quantify that piece? I mean, because as I'm talking with Dave, what's he's at? Both hips, both shoulders, like the amount of joints. And like, he's like, I'm in all this pain. And then he asked me, he's like, you in pain? I'm like, not right now. Like what is my perception of pain? Like I don't have, and like, that's another interesting thing. I mean, you know, that's why people end up, getting addicted to drugs and painkillers and this. I mean, it's such an interesting piece, but that people talk about, but it's next to impossible to quantify because it's so personal.
As coaches and trainers, we professionally deal with two of the most subjective things in the world together: human movement and pain. 90%+ of people that are training today are in some level of pain or old injury or movement dysfunction that is causing them some aches or injuries. And this is the norm. And I want to clearly state that it's like, pain is not always danger, but pain is information that we need to utilize if we want to be able to overcome it over time, or at least put ourselves into a better position to feel better on the day-to-day, year-to-year, decade-to-decade. But pain is an interesting one because, as you alluded to, everyone's perception of pain is totally different. It's a unique profile. I'm still a big believer in subjective pain scaling. In my experience, if we can get somebody under a 4 out of 10 subjective pain scale, whatever that might mean to them, we see that they have the ability to actually gain a training stimulus, be able to unlock their movement system, and have a positive adaptation that day. Anything more than like a 4 out of 10 subjective pain scale, people end up guarding in some sort of way, compensating. Even if they can get through and perform optimally, they'll redline their system and the next day they'll have the repercussions. I don't think it's so acute where it's like here and now is all that matters. It's an entire spectrum of length of where it can actually be affected. So I do believe that it is possible to get somebody absolutely pain-free. But I also believe that people that are pain-free will have nagging aches and pains and injuries, and sometimes even catastrophic injuries in their lifetime. The data sets will just show that to be true. But I think that we need to be more cognizant of like, you know, what does pain-free actually mean? Because pain-free doesn't mean that you're just like Teflon Don, you're just bulletproof for life. Nothing will ever happen to you. That's not the reality. I don't care if you're powerlifting. I don't care if you're playing NFL football. I don't care if you're totally inactive and you sit on your couch and you sit at a desk and you sit all day and you have 2,300 steps per day, which is like 25% of the American population today. Everyone's dealing with shit. But I do believe that if we can control the frequency of pain and flare-ups, that's a win. If we can control the intensity or severity of pain and flare-ups, that's also a win. If when we do have pain or flare-ups, we can actually self-autonomously control our road back to being pain-free, that's a huge win. And of course, if we can just avoid pain altogether, that is the ultimate win. Now, random shit's gonna happen. That's what people always try to argue against us with. You know, there's no such thing as pain-free. Things will happen. You could trip off a curb and sprain your ankle. That's not pain-free. I absolutely agree. But I think that there are certain things in the world, training being one of them, that we have more control over our body's health and function and pain-free status than we think. It's not inevitable that you're just going to lift weights and always end up hurt. I can tell you right now that I was as injury prone as anyone has ever been. You know, in 2006, I was going into the Major League Baseball draft as one of the top ranked high school players in the country. And guess what? I had a Tommy John UCL tear. And you know, that set me back and I never got back after that.
Yeah, it sucks.
And my perception of that pain was a lot different. But after that, it was hamstring tears into college. I ended up going to Division I baseball, hamstring tears in college, tore my other UCL diving for a ball in center field my sophomore year. So it was injury, 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 injury. I lived in pain. I became a strength and conditioning coach at the University of Buffalo, and I had awesome mentors there, but they came from Westside Barbell for Athletes, and they were just pounding the power lifts. And guess what? I was going to pound the power lifts. I learned at age 21 and 22 that if I wanted to be big and strong, that I'm going to be in pain. My back's going to hurt when I go to graduate school classes. My shoulder's going to hurt after bench press day, and my hips are going to hurt after squatting. And that led to not an awesome experience with training. You know, academically, I was getting really smart, but my own body, I was dealing with pain and injuries in my playing career that led me not to where I wanted to be. And then boom, I'm in a Division I strength and conditioning center. I'm still hurt and I'm training clients and athletes. And then it wasn't until I actually started getting mentorship around, hey, physical therapy, rehabilitation, working in pain science, being able to look at sports performance coaches that knew very well that pain was going to be an issue. And the only thing that we needed to do in the off season was get these guys healthy. That was the light bulb epiphany moment for me. It's like, you had the knowledge, but I was in my own way. Hey, I needed to be in pain if I want to play baseball. I needed to be in pain if I wanted to be taken seriously by my mentors in the weight room at UB. I needed to be in pain to go in and chase my strength endeavors. I didn't. You know, today, reaching 40 years old, I'm not in pain. I haven't been hurt in 10 years, and I feel good on a daily basis, and I'm stronger. I'm not as big, but I'm leaner, and I'm performing better than I was when I was 19, 18, getting ready for the draft. So it's like, these things are possible, but I had to make a total 180 shift on the way that I was thinking about how we train intelligently. And just putting my ego aside and knowing very well that it was going to be a process to build back up differently. I think that we all need to go through this process. Some of us are forced into it. Those are the clients that I work with. And others of us are a little bit smarter than I was. And we know that there needs to be a smarter way. And we got out in front of it before this ever actually impedes the quality of our life.
Killer, man. If someone listening to this podcast goes all in and wants to buy pain-free performance, what's one thing that you could offer them to improve their training and get them out of pain? Is there like one nugget, like one thing? Is it unilateral training? Is it learning to lunge, neutral hip? Like one piece, just one takeaway.
I think that you're going to be able to have a unique movement system profile for all six foundational movement patterns: squat, hinge, lunge, push, pull, carry. You're going to learn how to train for your body, not anyone else's, and not based on a generic goal. And I think that that is absolutely liberating no matter what your ultimate goal is with training. And that's the cornerstone of the pain-free performance system, is optimization and individualization around a unique movement profile, because we all need something individual to our specific bodies. And I think that that is just been discounted for far too long.
Cool. So if people want to get the book, what's the easiest way to get it?
Amazon. Amazon's awesome because it usually has it on sale, Amazon Prime next day, and the best pricing over there.
Awesome, dude. That was great, man. I'm so happy we got to connect. Dave spoke very highly of you, and I'm more than excited to have got the book and gone through it. So thanks for coming on. And if people want to get a hold of you, easiest way, social media.
Yeah, social media is great, at Dr. John Russin, DrJohnRussin. Facebook, Instagram, also YouTube. You can check me out there.
Awesome. Well, dude, thanks for tuning in. Another episode of Power Athlete Radio. See ya. This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales we've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's ko-fi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.